military representatives at these meetings.
For instance, the colonel, you said.
I have no idea what their names were. There was a colonel at the PFF Interagency Task Force, and there were one or two colonels on the roles and mission study.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know who there was on the combined campaign plan. That was a that was more of a paper exercise run by George Jacobson, as I recall.
Okay. The name Bob Montague ring a bell?
Yeah, it does, and I can't tell you right now what it, all it does is ring a bell.
Okay.
I know the name. It's
Charles Cook. Charles M. Cook.
Charles Cook does not ring.
Okay. Or George Dexter.
George Dexter does.
Okay. He was SACSA, Special Assistance for Counterinsurgency and Special Activities, from out of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
To either Krulak in 64 or Roland Anthus, or eventually probably Depew.
Who?
General Depew.
You mean, these are all Marine generals, aren't they?
Some of them are Army.
Krulak,
but Krulak was a Marine.
Krulak.
And he's the one who wrote that.
Yeah.
That.
Okay, no, I didn't. If that's who he was, I didn't know him then, because that doesn't mean any goes
okay.
Well there.
Okay. I've not been able
but
to...
But who were they special assistants to? I mean, they were these people, but in what capacity? Were they in Vietnam or in Washington?
I believe they were in Washington making trips out to Vietnam to do studies to then report back to Washington so they could develop their policy.
I could have talked to them, but,
okay.
But I don't.
Montague was working for Comer on the military, you know, on RD.
Was he a captain?
I don't remember, but he's often credited with creating the, or being him and Richard Holbrook being the force behind the reorganization of 66.
Well, that's a bunch of that, aren't
Yeah, right. Well, that's
but,
the military.
Well,
it,
wait, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say that, because those guys, they did come out. Comer himself came out. He was a frequent visitor.
Yeah.
And you come right down to it. I can't say where the real pressure for the OCO reorganization in 1966 came from.
Mm-hmm.
But it very well could have been through the Comer, Holbrook, Montague.
Yep.
Montague was the guy, as a matter of fact, he was a military officer, wasn't he?
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, he was a captain then.
Okay.
He was the guy that invited me over to my one visit to the White House, and I had lunch down in the White House cafeteria and the old executive office building. And this is after Comer had gone out there, and I guess it was Rostow. No, I don't know who it was.
Well, Comer worked for Rostow. At the National Security Council.
Well, Rostow was gone by the time all this happened.
Okay.
But I forget who Comer's replacement was. I remember spending an hour with him. Those are beautiful, that beautiful building. Have you ever been in? Gives you the it just seeps with tradition and history. I mean, even though it's not there.
Yeah.
But it gives you this ambiance, this British ambiance, this telling me about as a child he'd done this and that, and he spent this, used to spend the time in the his uncle's library or grandfather's or something with all this Joseph Conrad and this and that.
Oh, certainly.
So I mentioned Heart of Darkness, and he told me how much of it. I said, Ralph, you're just another 19th century romantic, just like the rest of them.
Sure.
So between Heart of Darkness and the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and a couple of other things that, as one of my friends said, the Seven Pillars of Wisdom recruited more guys into the Middle East than any other thing that any CIA recruiter had ever done.
Yep.
And the same way with Heart of Darkness and with a couple of other things. In my case, it's All's Fair and The White Lady by Henry Landau, which is British Behind the Lines Intelligence Networks in the First World War.
Sounds something like Four Feathers.
Much better.
Much better, okay. But those are the books that, as a you know, English literature fires the imagination,
yeah.
And it's a much easier world to live in. I don't know if people read the ends of the books, Heart of Darkness, but if they did, they wouldn't want to get involved. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that's part of the that's yeah. part of the reading.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, okay. I've gotten into a digression here, but that's what the old executive, and that's where Montague.
Okay.
They invited me over there, and we had brief Comer's replacement, and then had lunch, as I say.
Wade Latham, I believe, is who replaced Comer.
Not at that time. No, okay. Wade Latham. I think he was still out in Vietnam.
Okay. One thing you were going to tell me about is the Ted Sarong flap. You meant Ted. We were just talking about the police field force.
Yeah.
And Ted Sarong had been the Australian who was running the field force, I suppose, at the time you got out there. Last time we talked, you said you had an interesting story to tell me about Ted Sarong. You want to put that on the back burner for a minute?
Boy, I sure don't remember what it was. You sure it was I that said that?
Yeah.
Is it on the tape?
It's on one of the older tapes. Yeah, the tapes I made last time that there
with
was...
My
you
voice.
Said, oh, remember to tell, you know, remind
Ted
me to tell
Sarong.
You about Ted Sarong.
Well, maybe it'll come to me.
Okay.
Maybe it'll come to me, but right at the moment, it doesn't ring any bells at all.
Okay.
And I may have had an interesting story to tell that's just dropped out of the memory bank. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. What about your relations with Tom Donahue in
Well,
Vietnam?
we had very little to do with each other. We had our separate program. We knew each other. We were friends. We drank beer together.
Okay.
We had this in the old embassy annex. This was the embassy that was blown up.
Yes, okay.
In February of 65. The old embassy annex, there was a bar down at the street level between the annex and the embassy proper. Okay.
Yeah.
There was the entire area was surrounded by barbed wire and barricades, and these big dragon's teeth to prevent cars from crashing through.
Yeah,
and so forth. Okay. 6 o'clock every night, with all these barricades were opened up, and there was a train. The train track went down past there, and there was this train, this engine, for God only knows what reason. Would always drive through there, and 10 minutes later would drive back. And I never did figure out what it was doing. All I did know was that everybody believed that one day the VC was going to have about a ton of plastic in this train.
Yeah.
So every day at 6 o'clock, this bar would go dead silent.
Yeah.
Everybody would listen to this train rumble. Well, anyway. A Donahue would be down.
Well, that was one of my also questions for you. What did you do for social life in Saigon? Is that pretty much
recent? Yeah, well,
most of the fellas
had Vietnamese girlfriends or American girlfriends.
Mm-hmm. Secretaries, office, whatever. Yeah.
Some of them did.
Yeah.
A number of guys would. We'd go down. We'd have our after office drinks and maybe soup, Chinese soup or something down there at the bar, and then we'd go our separate ways.
Okay.
Sometimes we'd go night clubbing.
Yeah.
Most of the time, I, for example, just went back to my barracks and apartment. But mostly read some TV, watch TV a little bit. There wasn't a whole lot on TV. Except the one thing the Vietnamese went ape about was this, who's the fellow that was blown up in the helicopter out and making film?
Combat. Vic Morrow.
Yeah, Vic Morrow in Combat. Sergeant, whatever.
Yeah, sure, rolling over France with his scruffy buddy.
That's right. Well, that was the most popular TV program in Vietnam.
Okay.
And,
not the most adult of...
No, we go around, perhaps have a few drinks, a few beers or something, and go our separate way.
Okay.
And
Huntington's.
Read, whatever term the individual on. Okay. I did a lot of walking. I've been walking for any section of Saigon, any time of night, 3 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. 5 o'clock in the morning.
Armed?
Unarmed.
Unarmed.
No.
Okay. Okay, very good. What about your relations with Donahue on when you're both on the staff at Special Assistant? Yeah.
Okay, well now, that's what happened there. In the reorganization, mm-hmm. The ROICs were established, and the PM people were brought under the roof organization here. I don't remember that Donahue was out there very long after that.
Okay.
But what happened was that we were moved over into another building,
mm-hmm.
and I was, my shop and my operation is called RDCP/P,
mm-hmm.
and the other operation was RDCO
mm-hmm.
operations. Okay. Donahue went home.
Yeah.
Or went someplace.
Yeah, he did.
And a guy by the name of Renz Huxham, R-E-N-Z, I think is the way it's spelled, H-O-E-K-S-E-M-A, came out from Washington, took over the shop.
Okay.
Renz Huxham had been he and I had done two tours in Tehran together.
Boy, I suppose you can imagine in the time since I last saw you how many questions I've wanted to ask you about Iran.
Yeah.
I'm laying in bed at night, you know, actually just saying to myself, now, stick to the point, though.
Yeah.
Stick to the point.
Well, all I got to say is that Jimmy Carter's failed rescue operation was based on one of our operational plans.
Really?
Well, even more than that. I think I told you, I'm not sure that I did, off the record, that we had planned operations up into Churatan.
That's right, yeah.
Staging it into the desert out there inside the USSR. Well, this is exactly what they did. They were staging into a deserted desert area in central Iran,
yeah.
And they had a lot of things go against them, unfortunately. But totally aside from the fact that the choppers didn't work.
Yeah, the sand got
but
up.
But the fact that these tourists or this bus of people came by when, under normal circumstances, there wouldn't be anybody in there for months at a time.
Yeah.
And this bus had to come by right at that particular time. Back onto the record, okay. But, yeah, this whole Iranian, mess is—it's unbelievable. It really is. It's just unbelievable.
Okay, but maybe we can talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay. According to the Pentagon Papers.
Oh, back to Renz Huxham.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. Huxham, we spent two tours together in Iran. He's retired, and he had an Australian wife, and I think they moved out to Australia.
Oh,
but I'm not sure.
Okay.
He's a hard-driving officer, very smart, one of our few PhDs, and but also one of those few that insisted on being called Dr. Huxham by people who he didn't know very well.
Yeah.
Lots of people.
Most people drop the formality.
That's
most
right.
Doctors I know,
he's
unless
one of those,
they're medical doctors.
He's one of those Dutch,
mm-hmm.
Dutchmen from the Middle West, Wisconsin, Michigan, something like that, of which I've known several
mm-hmm.
in the agency. And also reading my history of the Dutch in the colonial period,
mm-hmm.
and in Indonesia, for example,
mm-hmm.
I have come to the conclusion that the Dutch are probably perhaps as ruthless
mm-hmm.
as any national ethnic group in this world.
They say that the problem
they are
with the
hard,
Dutch
ruthless people.
there's an old poem that they say that the problem with the Dutch is giving too little and taking too much.
okay. He was a hard driving officer, and they're a ruthless bunch of people, and he was too.
Sure, and you read about the Boer War.
He was an expert at, he was also an expert at self-promotion, okay. Which I'll touch on a little bit later.
Very good. All right, back to the reorganization. In the Pentagon Papers, it said previously they, meaning Special Branch and National Police, being the CIA, had both advised the same people through, previously they had both advised the same people through separate channels which met only at the top, right, they being CIA and aid. When the Chief of Public Safety Branch and the Deputy Chief of Station had something urgent and specific to resolve, it was the only time that the two would get together. Deliberate compartmentalization before OCO was formed.
And it remained after OCO too.
Okay, that's the, my point is, it says before, and that's the word I have under. What about after? Is there still the compartmentalization? Yeah, this suggests that there isn't.
Yeah, well, there was. I mean, there was never any real need for lower level liaison, or the liaison at province level was almost automatic.
Okay.
And I suppose there were problems that arose out there that from time to time had to be resolved by the chief of police, public safety advisor in Saigon and the deputy chief of station.
Okay.
But by and large, there wasn't a whole lot that we necessarily had to do with each other. We financed the special branch.
Okay.
They financed the rest of the police.
Okay.
We trained the special branch. We maintained liaison with the special branch. Mm-hmm. Any problems between the chief of the special branch and the chief of the local police in province was a problem they had to resolve, by and large. So, but yes, the intelligence operation, for all of being integrated into these other things, still did retain its own separate identity.
Right.
And it retained its own privacy, if you will.
Okay.
Now, John Monopoly, we got along great, but we didn't have much. We sat on committees together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like this PFF committee.
Yeah, all right. And then there's another one, the RFPF, the Regional Forces and Popular Forces, at one time were destined to be provincial and district constabulary. Do you remember that?
I used the term gendarmerie.
Yeah.
I should have used the term constabulary.
Okay.
This is what the Army was after.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
That was what I was saying in my letter about there must have been some good arguments.
Okay. What that RFPF business was?
Okay.
It was on the RFPF had gone under military control in previous years, and I personally didn't get involved with it, nor did I make myself knowledgeable about it. So I can't really respond to that question.
That's fine. It's not something that is of tremendous interest in anyway. My next question was the one that we discussed earlier about these officers, 44 officers in April, who become the ISEX officers, which we've discussed. My question is are they taken, drawn from the military to become the ISEX officers as a way of giving the military input into the system? Because these people would then be reporting back to their
Okay. What it was, the whole thing was that the agency had been getting more and more leery of becoming as deeply involved in these interagency programs.
Okay.
This goes back to the big battle of fall of 1966.
Okay.
Which one of the options, when we talk about ISEX and we talk about OCO, we have to recall that one of the options was complete agency withdrawal from these operations and activities.
It says the CIA and USIA officers in the field refused to accept guidance from OCO representatives.
Yeah, well, that happened too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
Were you involved in the decision to draw these people from the military?
No, what it was once the decision was made that we will become committed to these programs.
Okay.
And we will become deeper involved rather than withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
Then the agency, which itself was running into manpower problems, began to turn more and more to recruitment of ex-military and ex-police people. Now, I already had a lot of contract people, but after the Comer thing, which was later than this, the Comer thing, they were actually seconding military officers to the agency for this program.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Now, that did not happen as an outcome of 1966 decision.
Okay.
But that was an outcome of the Comer.
Okay.
Of the reorganization, if you will, or the organization, I should say, of ISEX and Phoenix in 1967.
Very good.
Now, here we're going after, and we're having military officers assigned to us.
Right.
And this is what happened with your presidential program that you were referring to earlier.
Presidential meaning in effect COVID.
In effect COVID.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Okay. Census grievance and John Woodsman, I don't suppose there's nothing more to add about that.
No. We were very interested in that program. We wanted access to its intelligence. We often, sometimes, were as badly compartmented within ourselves, more than we should be.
Okay.
The police could not necessarily absorb this stuff.
Okay.
And, of course, the basic contract with the Vietnamese peasant was that anything that was learned in census grievance would not be turned over to the authorities, to the police.
Okay, so the reason for that?
Well, to gain the confidence of to get the peasantry to cooperate.
So there must have been conflict then between the two.
There was certain, really conflict. We had almost nothing to do with each other, put it that way. But it was still something that we would very much like to have tapped into because they could get intelligence that we weren't getting.
So this is part of the ISEX formula, is to bring all these things together.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
The census grievance thing is a very clever type of informant operation, is what it is.
Yes, that was the thrust of what I discussed with Donahue.
Yeah.
Was census grievance.
It's a very good way to go about organizing informant networks. And the difficulty was caused by the fact that the tacit contract with the Vietnamese source informants, clients, if you will, whatever, was that the police wouldn't have anything to do with this stuff.
Okay.
It was for the province chief's advice and guidance.
Okay.
That's the formula. But see, they took the census grievance stuff and they turned around and used that in the CTs, PRUs, and whatever else they had going on.
Okay.
I suppose they might turn something over to the military sector or subsector.
Now, one of the things we were going to discuss was the six ROIKs.
Oh yeah, just to straighten out what was said last time, because the field operations regional offices were in Da Nang, Nha Trang, Ban Ma Thuot, Dinh Hoa, Nhi Tho, and Can Tho. Okay, the ROIKs were set up on the same basis. But then, and I forget how the damn thing was resolved.
So at some point it gets reduced to four, right?
OCO was based on the military tactical CTZs, which were the four military regions, the core areas, I should say, CTZs. And so that was Nha Trang, Tenang.
Benoit.
I guess it was Benoit and Canto.
That's right.
So whether we ever did away with two of our Roycks, I don't know.
I don't know either, but I think so.
Yeah. Okay, so. Now, and this is something I was going to touch on earlier, but didn't. Mm-hmm. And it's in my notes, but I'll cover it now, and then when I go through my notes, we can skip through it quickly.
Okay.
But our communication setup was that we had a single sideband radio telephone with Kravitz, as did the PM shop. A lot of stuff was, most of our traffic was in the clear. And this was aircraft flights and this and that. All of our province officers, as well as our regional officers, this is field ops, also had one-time pads by which they could encrypt messages, and then we would have voice code transmissions. And we would get called at 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd sit on a goddamn SSB for two and a half hours taking down numbers. And then we're spending three more hours decrypting this thing. So people didn't use this very often anymore than this. The constant problem in terms of our Saigon operation, our Saigon direction of this show, was that a province officer should not properly receive instructions or directions from Saigon.
He gets it from his regional officer.
So we had a lot of cases where we'd have to tell a guy to shut up, turn off his radio, go back and contact his regional officer and talk to him.
Okay.
That takes a certain discipline. The temptation is to go ahead and tell him what to do.
Yeah.
And so we didn't. Now in the on the PM side of the shop.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, that's the way they were set up. So they'd tell him what to do,
okay,
or whatever the problem was, they'd solve it. After the Roycks were set up, we basically set up bases. We did not set up bases at these places for legal reasons, and I forget what those legal reasons were, but we did not want to establish a station with six bases in Vietnam. Now, in most countries will have a station, will have a base. If we take Germany, for example, the station is in Bonn, you have Berlin base, you have Frankfurt base, you have Hamburg, you have a couple of others, Munich, and I don't know what else. There were technical, legal reasons, and I don't remember what they were, but we didn't want to do that in Iran.
In Iran?
In Vietnam.
Okay.
But we did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We set up vaults. The engineers went out there and built vaults in each of these places. Set up the complete multi-channel automatic teleprinter cryptographic systems, radio communications, so that by the time I left, we had six full base operations with the full communication support to the Roycks.
Okay.
Now that carries certain hazards with it too, and the hazards are that when you have a base like that with all that elaborate commo gear and everything, you have files and records.
Yeah.
And these are what are almost never destroyed when they should be, and are captured by bases overrun.
I interviewed Tom Polgar.
Okay, Tom Polgar.
And he told me that not one American record was last chief of station, but he was there during the fall.
Yeah.
He said that no American files or records were left behind, that they were all destroyed.
I don't believe it.
Yeah. Well, that
I simply don't believe it.
Yeah. He's now become
George Cave
Oh, yeah, well...
What?
Force advisor.
Air Force
Secord
advisor.
Secord is in Iran in 62 to 63 as advisor to the Iranian Air Force.
Well, I've had him at parties in my house then, but I don't know him personally. Yeah. Our main relationship in Iran is with the military and naval attachés.
Okay.
Well, one of them turned out to be a Soviet agent, by the way. He was shot himself. The colonel, what's his name, the air attaché.
Wow.
And, you know, you run into some strange things in this business. This Middle Eastern guy that blasted himself away with a shotgun about 3 years ago here in Washington, espionage,
yeah.
Working for the Pentagon.
Yeah, okay.
Working for the Pentagon. Well, of course, he was a retired CIA guy. A fairly close friend of mine. He used to come to our retirement parties. We have a luncheon down Fort Myers every other month.
Hmm.
Waldo Deberstein was his name.
I remember him, sure. He was, oh yeah.
He was little. He was, I mean, really a Casper Milfield type of guy or Laura Mitty or something.
Hmm.
Because he was about as ugly as they come, billiard bald, billiard head baldness and all that. So apparently he just got tired of his wife and got shagging up with this young broad and went from bad to worse.
Classic case.
And finally he pulled himself up with a shotgun and came under when he was invited for this one.
Okay.
So we don't talk about him in our functions. I mean, there are several people who don't talk about him. He's one of them.
Yeah.
It's bad business there. Okay, next question.
Okay. When you moved over to OCO, your new boss, this is sort of a...
This is Lou Lapp.
Right, okay. Suggested a reduction of police special branch field operations in favor of unilateral espionage into the VC.
No.
Okay.
No, that's incorrect.
Okay.
Howard Stone, who came out there as chief of FI operations.
Okay.
Earlier in the year. 1966? Yeah, I guess it was 66 when he came out there.
Okay.
He pressed very hard in that direction, and I refused to have anything to do with it.
Okay.
And as a result, he set up a separate shop that took my best operations away from me, which is always a source of resentment. Stone and I later became the best of friends, but not at this period of time.
So he then... when you say your best agents in the field, then, is what he took away from you?
Yeah, if we had a penetration into a VC province committee, he'd send another officer and take the case away from us, and then we'd never hear from it again.
Was there a reason for that?
Yeah, he was interested in high-level penetrations
of
the Viet Cong, and I was interested in fighting the counterinsurgency war.
Okay.
This is one of the underlying... There's a constant chronic conflict. It's
mm-hmm.
built in. I mean, you cannot avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there. There's a tension.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are two different purposes.
Yeah.
And you're utilizing basically the same resources.
So, in a sense, we're out of the three, the informants, the interrogations, and
the penetrations.
The penetrations, in effect, were taken away from special field ops, right?
They wanted to. They don't... What they'd do is they'd send an officer out in province and ask our people to introduce them to the go-between.
Go-between, yeah, okay.
And then, these would have to be our unilaterals.
Yeah.
See, because out in the province, the police special branch, we would provide advice and guidance, quote, close quote. We hope we knew more than the Vietnamese, but that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
For their penetrations into the VC. But off on the side,
yeah.
Maybe through Chu Hoi or maybe through some other resource,
yeah.
We would develop an independent unilateral penetration unknown to the police.
Okay.
And we had a number of those around the country.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing that Rocky Stone's Special Operations Branch was interested in reviewing, and if it was any good, they'd take it away from us.
Okay. Did you know Ogden Williams, who was the head of the Chu Hoi program out there?
No.
A guy named Norman Briers, who also had a role in it? Okay. Did you have an interest in Chu Hoi program?
Well, very much so,
very
yeah.
Okay.
My motto
what's the,
was...
What's the relation?
My motto, and okay. I'm not sure, this is off the record, and I'm not sure that I'd want you to use it, because it's appeared in print.
Okay.
And I don't like to see it. But my motto was to recruit them. If you can't recruit them, capture them. If you can't capture them, let's see. If you can't recruit them, defect them. True boy. If you can't defect them, capture them.
Okay.
If you can't capture them, kill them. That was my attitude towards a high-level BCI.
Okay.
And as I say, that's off the record. Now we can go back on the record.
Okay, but in...
But you've seen that in print someplace, I think, or something close to it. I know I have.
Yeah. Well, Colby is, I've heard Colby say the same thing.
Okay, well, he got it from me then.
Okay.
Because
okay.
I'm the one that coined that particular expression.
Right. Well, Colby used that as in the congressional hearings to say that, you know, the killing was down here. It wasn't Phoenix was not an assassination program. Killing was the last resort.
Mm-hmm.
That was where... That when he was expressing the logic of the program.
Yeah.
Okay. But this guy Ogden Williams, who was Agency for International Development person and supposedly set up Chu Hoi in Vietnam, said there was no relation between Chu Hoi and police operations, and there was no relation between Chu Hoi and Phoenix later on, which has just been, from the evidence that I've been able to uncover, completely untrue that they are. Especially with the detention
we
centers.
The screening, the one the that's, guys were when yeah. the guys were interrogated. That's where we would get in. And occasionally the police. I don't care what the Americans said on this. The police had their police special branch had their knickers into that as deep as they could get them. Because that, of course, is your real source of. Your latest intelligence on the one hand,
yeah.
often your best,
mm-hmm.
because some of these defectors were fairly high level.
Yeah, sure.
But more than that, your best leads to back into penetration operation back into the apparatus.
Yeah.
Okay, now I finally found a copy of Embassy House.
Oh, you did, yeah.
Not in paper, but in hardback.
Yeah.
Something you said led me to believe it was in paperback.
No, it's because it's recent.
Yeah.
Books don't come out in paper for a year anyway.
For a year, yeah, okay. I finally got a copy of that and read that, and that's quite good.
Yeah.
That's quite good.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it points out in there, and this is one of our constant fears within that program, the whole set of programs, was where the VC, the allegation that the VC would use this, and I'm sure they did,
mm-hmm.
Use the Chu Hoi program as R&R for their people.
Mm-hmm.
That they'd defect and go down and spend a month or several months getting good food.
Yeah, no,
understood
within the people I talked to that's just...
But, aside from that,
yeah.
there were a lot of legitimate defectors in there, and most mm-hmm. of them, your coming down here and meeting with me has been good for me in ways that you probably never anticipated. I think I mentioned before that I've never been able to read or talk to people about Vietnam, really.
I understood that.
Before you came.
Yeah, no, this is something...
I couldn't read a thing about it. It's broken to Dan Luce or something, so I've swallowed up a bunch of these books, and Tunnels of Kuchi is one of them. Which is very fascinating because it answers some questions that I had known. When that tank disappeared down at Willowdale one night, everybody was baffled. And I remember that incident so clearly.
You do, okay.
And now, tons of Kuchi, they tell us where it went.
Yeah.
And, of course, I had a son-in-law who was an infantry patrolman in the Kuchi district, too. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was Dentre or something. But then...
That's the province capital in Hau Nia. Yeah.
But then, there was Tons of Kuchi, this other one on, his name I forget, I have the book here though, but this fellow who was a first air cadet.
Is it a recent book?
Well,
this Fields of Fire, which is supposed to be real good.
This is
back on
stage.
Okay, so you go over to RDC in...
Rent section goes over to RDC.
In
RDC.
Okay, and that happens when OCO is formed.
Lou Lappin arrived there. Yeah, we were there before Lou got in the country.
Are you still head of the field, special branch field operations?
Yes, we took the special field operations away.
So you still have that title and those duties?
No, I have the title now of chief of RDC.
Oh, okay.
P.
Okay.
For plans.
All right.
I mean, my title
changes. Your duties are basically the same.
My duties are basically the same, except theoretically working toward a coordinated operation.
Okay. Now, when does Dave West arrive?
Dave West arrives about... I made abundantly clear that I was not going to extend my tour beyond a certain... beyond my tour date in June.
Okay.
I made that clear early. So they brought Dave West in about the... because frequently, you know, what they do is they don't get a replacement out there for you, and then they twist your arm and stay on until someone...
Okay.
And they never bring the guy out, and you're stuck with it. So...
all employers do that.
Yeah. So I just made it crystal clear that I was not going to stay.
Okay.
And so they brought Dave West out there about the... it was around the 1st of May or so, maybe the last week of April, something like that.
And... would he have been involved in Phoenix then? In his duties as chief of RDCP, would he be somebody for me to contact?
There was something else. Another change took place in the OCO reorganization.
Okay.
The previous fall. And that was that whereas prior to the reorganization, Tom Donahue and Nelson Bricken were supervisors, line of command to the field operations. As of the reorganization, we lost that status. We became staff officers too. Chief RDC, who was Lou Lappin, Deputy Chief of Station for Revolutionary Development. I should say DC/RD.
Okay. And he's in effect a second deputy chief of station.
He's a second deputy chief of station for this program.
Okay.
The line of command now went from chief of station to the deputy chief of station for RD. To the ROIC.
Okay.
To the province officer.
Okay.
Now see that previously it had been me to the regional officer, to the province officer. Or on Tom Donahue's side, from Tom Donahue to the province officer.
Okay. Okay.
Now all that's changed. So Rance Huxema and I are both running branches as staff assistants to... now what this
is
meant...
Is Stone still around then?
No, Stone is out of the picture.
Okay.
Because we were taken away from the station.
Okay. I got it.
Yeah, okay. And we're now under the supervision of the second deputy chief of station.
Okay.
Outside the regular station. Now then, it made little difference, except that the Roycks would frequently thumb their noses at Rents or myself.
Okay.
They didn't have to. We removed from status where if we said something, it was an order.
Mm-hmm.
To where if we said something, it was a suggestion. And they could tell us to go screw ourselves. It's happened on more than one occasion.
Okay. And this is just the natural outcome of the
reorganization. That's
right. Okay.
I mean, I didn't object to it. Neither did Rince. I mean, you couldn't run it the other way.
Right. No, I understand. I understood when Hart left, is it true that Horgan became acting chief of station until Shackley showed up?
I doubt it very much. I don't know.
Was there somebody in there between Hart and Shackley?
This was after I left.
Okay.
So I really don't know.
Hart was there until you left.
He was there after I left.
He was there after.
I left before he did. But,
okay. Very good.
And he was still there, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. But when I went back, see, I came home in June.
That's right.
And I turned around and went back out on TDY with F. Park.
Okay.
Park was still there as of the time I was on TDY, and that was until into October.
Okay.
So it was, I think it was that December, that Hart had his second occurrence of detached retina.
Okay.
The dumb bastard wouldn't play tennis so much, he probably wouldn't have had that, but he...
Incidentally, that guy...
trying to preserve his youth.
Kelly A. Campera,
yeah.
And I did not mention it to him at all, said that John Hart was a megalomaniac.
Well, I wouldn't. That's pretty close, yeah. I wouldn't want to be quoted on it, but basically I have a few notes about that in here myself.
Okay.
A few stories to tell you.
I'm getting close to the end here, so, and some of it's already been...
Yeah, he was a megalomaniac.
When Hart assigned
anyway,
you...
Anyway, he went home.
Okay.
But Horgan, I doubt very much, was brought down from Da Nang as acting chief of station.
Who is Horton, John Horton?
John Horton. Now, that's something different.
Could it have been John Horton?
It could have been a John Horton, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, Horton would have come out there after I...
Okay.
After what he was a senior officer of the agency.
Okay, because
and may very well have gone out as deputy chief of station or as temporary chief of station.
Okay, because I've talked with people and they have said Horgan.
But never Horgan. Horgan would not go in as ACOS.
Okay.
I'm certain.
Okay. Did you know Kinloch Bull?
Absolutely. He was my. He was a strange person. I don't know, you've probably talked to him, or if you haven't...
I haven't talked to him, but I've talked with people who worked with him.
Yeah,
okay.
He was a strange person.
Was he a deputy of yours?
He was the Kanto regional officer when I came out there. And so he was my regional officer up until the time that Roiks were appointed. And then he was made a Roik. He was one of the few FI people who became a Roik. He ran a boarding school up down there in Canton. I don't know whether any of your guys have told you about this, but he would preside at the head of the table. I don't know whether this is described in Embassy House or not, but it seems to me that one of the guys in Embassy House seemed an awful lot like Kinloch Bull. He was a bachelor, and I'm not sure that today that I'm not sure it wasn't fair. Or could have been.
Okay.
He wasn't, because the agency wouldn't have.
The person who told me about him was a Navy SEAL? Who is?
But really?
Let it go no further than that,
well,
okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Well,
but birds of a feather.
Doesn't surprise me. Uh-huh. Kinloch was very tall. He stood about 6'2".
Okay.
And he was thin as a rail. On visit. But they seemed to... he was a favorite. And he was pushed career-wise by Bill Colby. He was one of Colby's proteges. And he went on from Vietnam, I don't know, he went on to, I don't know what he did, I think he was sent to National War College, or some high muckety-muck thing.